Hello and welcome to edition number 2118 of the Whitney Talking News, which we're recording, as usual, in the High Street Methodist Church in Whitney, today, Thursday the 23rd of July. My name's Byron Russell and I edited this edition. Our readers today are Jill Breakspear, Tina Ewens, Alan Revell and Mick Walsh. Our technical expert is Peter Brading, and Peter's beside me now at the mixing desk, managing everyone's recordings this week. In this edition, we have news and editorial items from the Whitney Gazette and the Oxford Mail. In part two of this edition, we have a short piece about the work of the Air Ambulance and the exciting steam fair in Whitney last weekend. But first, we have part one, a good place to start, and we begin with Jill, who's got interesting news of an upgrade to Whitney's shopping centre. Over to you, Jill.
Upgrade plan announced for town's shopping centre. An upgrade scheme has been announced at an Oxfordshire shopping centre, with a councillor behind the plans promising that it will make the area nicer. West Oxfordshire District Council is investing in a programme of improvements at Marriott's Walk shopping centre. The project will see upgraded and additional seating, the planting of trees to redesign of the redesign of woodland and improved wayfinding and signage. The council has said this comes after a 28.6% year-on-year increase in footfalls at Marriott's Walk, with 20 out of 21 retail units currently occupied. Duncan Enright, Executive Member for Economic Development, said that since the local authority purchased the district in 2023, it has been delivering value for our communities and that the past year has been incredibly positive for the hub. He explained that it has generated more than £450,000 as a contribution to local services in the 2025-26 period. The Labour politician added, "We are now building on that success with investment into making the space nicer for people to use. With occupancy at its highest level ever and strong demand for space, Marriott's Walk is well positioned to build on its success through 2026, continuing to attract new businesses, deliver memorable events and enliven the town centre at the heart of our town." While Conservative councillor Thomas Ashby welcomed the refresh, he was clear that it shouldn't come at the taxpayers' expense. "Since this administration," he explained, "chose to buy the shopping centre, any improvements must be funded directly by the revenue it generates." He added, "Public realm enhancements are a good step, but urgent priority must be given to essential infrastructure, like fixing frequently broken lifts and unsafe doors. Ultimately, the council must consult Whitney residents on what they actually want to see, ensuring the space becomes genuinely welcoming so our town can thrive long into the future. Although Marriott's Walk Shopping Centre is performing well, other areas of Whitney are reportedly struggling. Whitney Chamber of Commerce has recently written to its local authorities and politicians after its members' trade-in figures declined by between 20 and 30% compared to last year. The harrowing claim comes amid major changes to the centre of the town, with construction works ongoing to upgrade the High Street and Market Square, where many of its members are based. Even so, the group said it welcomed the Marriott's Walk scheme and anything else that encourages people to spend time and money in the town. This includes its plan to ensure that businesses in Whitney are well advertised.
If you want to become rich beyond the dreams of avarice, become a Thames Water boss. Alan, tell us all about their bonuses.
Yes, indeed. The headline is outrageous £4 million bonus payment for utility bosses. Thames Water has been criticised by the Environment Secretary for handing outrageous payouts to top bosses. the troubled supplier forked out more than £4 million in bonuses and boosted its chief executive's pay to £1.2 million, according to new figures. Britain's biggest water firm, Thames, which has been left on the brink of nationalisation as it struggles under a £20 billion debt pile, revealed in its annual report that bonuses of £4.09 million were paid to, quote, key management personnel as part of its so-called management retention plan. It said the bonuses were made to board members and executives over the year to March 31st, up from £2.8 million the previous year, and these included performance-related and retention awards. The report also showed Chief Executive Chris Weston's total pay rose to £1.16 million in the year to March 31, up from £1.04 million in 24-25, after he picked up a £99,000 retention payment deferred from a previous year. His basic pay was also hiked by 14% from April the 1st this year to £995,000. Environment Secretary Emma Reynolds took aim at the Thames Water payouts, saying it adds to evidence that suppliers are sidestepping bans on bosses' bonuses. She said, "It's outrageous that one of the worst performing water companies is handing out bonuses and inflation-busting pay rises to its executives. It flies in the face of basic fairness, and the British public are right to be furious. We've banned bosses for polluting, bonuses for polluting water bosses, and we will be taking action to prevent bonuses by any other name." Last year's Water Brackets Special Measures Act allowed the regulator Ofwat to ban performance-related bonuses for bosses of utilities failing customers and the environment as part of the government's wider response to cracking down on the ailing sector. Mr. Weston said his £99,000 retention bonus was awarded before the Act came into effect in June last year, and the group confirmed he did not receive a performance-related payout for 25-26. But the firm has already caused controversy over retention payments to senior executives seen as evading the ban. It agreed last December, amid outcry, to pause £2.46 million of these payments to 21 of its top bosses. These are not thought to include Mr. Weston until further notice, having already paid out a similar amount earlier in the year. In its annual report, Thames Water's Remuneration Committee said the committee fully accepts and complies with the legal and regulatory position on performance-related pay, but is concerned that the constraints now operating materially limit the extent to which the scale and challenge of the transformation being delivered can be reflected in total remuneration. Now, I've got a related story underneath this, which is also about Thames Water. Thames Water has issued a fresh update on a potential hosepipe ban after the company faced significant demand recently. Over the weekend, the company said it had seen significant increase in demand amid high temperatures. This has been due to the record-breaking heat and tropical nights, leading to more water use by customers. It said daily household water usage went up by an average of 30%. Andrew Tucker, water demand reduction manager at Thames Water, said, "We saw a significant rise in demand across the region recently, particularly for outdoor water use. Demand increased so sharply in some areas that people were using water faster than we could produce and move it through our network. We'd like to thank customers who played their part by reducing usage during this extreme weather, helping to keep supplies flowing while staying hydrated and safe." In a previous statement, the company said that hot water was coming and every drop counted. "There is no hosepipe ban in place for Oxfordshire or any Thames Water-led area. The water company has, however, encouraged customers in these areas to use water wisely this week, particularly around outdoor use. In addition to this, river levels, reservoir levels and groundwater levels are all continually being monitored. Thames Water users can expect to be updated regularly should anything change with regard to bans as the summer progresses.
Thanks, Alan. Apparently Count Binface, who is standing in the Clacton by-election, has pledged to make Thames Water executives take a compulsory swim in the rivers that they have polluted. Sounds like an excellent initiative to me. Anyway, now more controversy, but this time it's about facial recognition and the authorities in Whitney using cameras and computers to potentially identify known criminals. Over to you, Tina.
Yes, facial recognition tech is criticised. A row has been sparked as controversial facial recognition tech is set to be used in Whitney. The former mayor of Whitney has criticised the live facial recognition technology being used by the police as flawed and discriminatory. Thames Valley Police was set to use the technology in Whitney Market Square earlier this month, but this was postponed due to resource pressures. The force added that it would let the public know of future deployments, indicating live facial recognition is still set for the town. The technology matches a digital image of human faces against known faces in a database and generates possible matches. Defending its use, a police spokesperson said, "We have rigorous legal mandates, equality impact statements and data protection impact assessments in place, all of which are available to the public." But Whitney Town Councillor and former Mayor Andy Bailey said there are numerous problems with the tech, adding, "We cannot allow Whitney to become a testing ground for a digital dragnet that relies on a systemic data bias, exhibits proven racial discrimination, and obliterates the British principles of policing by consent." Citing his work with the global campaign Stop Killer Robots, he said, "These models suffer from significantly high or false positive rates when scanning women, young people, and individuals with darker skin tones." He also claims the cameras go against the principle of policing by public consent, adding, "We must draw a hard line against invasive technology before it's permanently woven into our local infrastructure. Until there is total transparency, independent oversight, and absolute proof that these systems do not discriminate based on gender or skin colour, I'm calling for an immediate moratorium on local facial recognition deployments." A force spokesperson dismissed Mr. Bailey's concerns. They said, "The technology used by Thames Valley Police for LFR has been tested by the National Physical Laboratory, who concluded that it's highly accurate and found there is no demographic bias. If a person's face is scanned and they're not on our predetermined watch list, no alert is generated and their image is deleted. To date, during LFR deployments, our engagement with members of the public and local businesses has been overwhelmingly positive. Furthermore, Thames Valley Police's most recent trust and confidence survey, published in 2025, shows that 96% of residents support using emerging technology, including LFR, with 67% saying they support the force in using LFR to help identify outstanding suspects.
Thanks, Tina. Interesting. Finally, in this last section, yet more controversy, and this time from Mick, and it's about plans to totally reorganise the County Council into three entirely separate operations. So what's being planned exactly?
The headline is, "Councils to be scrapped as county to split into three." There are fears of a land grab for new housing with a decision to abolish Oxfordshire's councils, which run services including roads, planning and education. The county, city and district authorities are set to be abolished and replaced by three new councils. The announcement was made in a ministerial statement at the House of Commons by Secretary of State for Housing Steve Reid, although he's no longer Secretary of State for Housing. The plan, put by the Labour-run City Council, has been chosen by the government and will see a Greater Oxford Council created, taking parishes from Charwell, South Oxfordshire and the Vale of White Horse. There will also be a North Oxfordshire Council with the remainder of Charwell, along with West Oxfordshire, and a Ridgeway Council taking up South Oxfordshire, the rest of the Vale of White Horse and West Berkshire. An overarching county council will no longer exist, and all powers previously separated between it and the districts will go to the new authorities. Critics suggested this plan would be a land grab for rampant development, but the City Council's cabinet says it will help achieve much-needed targets and affordable homes. The new councils will come into force in April 2028. The existing councils will run until then. There will be elections for a temporary shadow authority or authorities next year to oversee the transition. A director for Oxfordshire's reorganisation is set to be paid a six-figure salary between £125,350 and £135,928 from the County Council payroll to manage this. Each new council is set to receive at least £900,000 from a £63 million government pot to support, quote, transition costs, unquote. Lib Dem-run district councils and county councils put forward different proposals for reorganisation. The districts of Charwell, South Oxfordshire, Vale of White Horse and West Oxfordshire proposed an Oxford and Shires Council. That's Charwell, Oxford City and West Oxfordshire. And a Ridgeway Council, which would have comprised South Oxfordshire, Vale of White Horse plus West Berkshire. The County Council wanted a single council to run Oxfordshire, incorporating all the districts and city councils without the inclusion of West Berkshire. At County Cabinet, fears have been shared about Oxfordshire residents bearing the brunt of West Berkshire Council's financial distress. The latter has secured government bailouts and exceptional financial support to avoid effective bankruptcy. Questions are raised about whether reorganisation should go ahead, with hopes shared by the local government association that a change of Prime Minister presents an opportunity to revisit some of the practicalities of the reforms.
Reactions to the announcement of council abolitions. Oxfordshire councillors have reacted with fury after the government's decision to abolish local councils. The announcement will see the county, city and district authorities replaced by three new councils, a reorganisation aimed at streamlining governance, cutting costs and tailoring services to local needs. But Councillor Susan Brown, leader of Oxford City Council, highlighted the positive significance of the change, stating, "This decision will shape the future of Oxford, Oxfordshire and West Berkshire for generations." According to Councillor Brown, concentrating development around Oxford will address housing needs while preserving green spaces. The new structure will prevent Witney and Banbury being overshadowed by Oxford, while South Oxfordshire and the Vale of White Horse can collaborate with West Berkshire. The decision has garnered backlash from councillors, MPs and residents alike, with MP to Bicester and Woodstock, Callum Miller, calling it political gerrymandering, and Oxfordshire County Council leader Tim Bearder called the decision deeply disappointing. The plan proposed by the Labour-run City Council will establish a Greater Oxford Council, incorporating parishes from Cherwell, South Oxfordshire and the Vale of White Horse. The existing overarching county council will be dissolved, with all powers transferred to the new authorities, which will commence operations in April 2028, with current councils continuing to function until then.
And the next story is headlined, Police Concerns About Hair Coursing. And the story reads, fresh warnings have been issued as hair coursing season is expected to begin earlier than usual. The Wantage and Grove neighbourhood policing team has raised concerns at the illegal activity, which involves using dogs to chase hares across open farmland. They say it tends to increase around this time of the year. Recent warm, dry weather has led to fields being cut sooner, raising the risk of hare coursing in the area on what will be then open ground. A spokesman for the team said, our rural communities are often our eyes and ears. If something feels wrong, trust your instincts and report it to us. Offenders frequently trespass onto private farmland, cause damage, and are sometimes linked to wider criminal activity.
The next headline is, drug driver who crashed into motorbiker avoids jail. A drugged-up driver who left a motorbike rider needing five operations after a crash at a busy Oxfordshire junction has walked away from court. Kevin Simpson was driving a Toyota Corolla at a crossroad junction near Carterton when he failed to spot biker José Suarez, despite him wearing a high-vis jacket. Simpson, 42, turned and crashed into Mr. Suarez, who was left screaming on the floor. When Simpson was tested for drugs, it was discovered he was well over the limit for cocaine and its breakdown product, benzoylecognine. After the crash, Suarez was in hospital for 20 days and had to have five surgeries for fractures to his ankle and foot. Simpson, of Trevellyn's Way, Watford, pleaded guilty to one count of causing serious injury by dangerous driving and two counts of drug driving. The court heard that the crash occurred on November the 13th last year at the crossroad junction of Burford Road with Upavon Way. Simpson was driving a Toyota Corolla at the time and drove into the path of the motorbike. He pulled over after the crash while Mr. Suarez was left screaming in pain. The court was told how the victim feared he may have his leg amputated due to the severity of his injuries. Simpson was arrested and tested positive for the drugs. He was found to have 32 micrograms of cocaine per litre of blood. The legal limit is 10, and he had 800 milligrams of BZE per litre of blood, when the legal limit is 50. Simpson was interviewed by police and was observed to be speaking constantly and was unable to sit still. He also repeatedly called himself an idiot and stupid. In the interview, he accepted that he was the driver, and he claimed to have not seen the motorbike. Mr. Suarez was taken to the John Radcliffe Hospital after the crash and found to have fractures to his ankle and foot. The court heard that Simpson had no previous convictions. A victim impact statement was read out on behalf of Mr. Suarez. It said, I was seriously injured when a car crashed into me while I was riding my motorbike. It affected me very seriously. I was badly injured on my right leg. I was on the ground and I was in intense pain. I'm still recovering from my injuries. My confidence has dropped massively. I can't be active at all. I'm scared that anything can happen on the roads. I was very angry about what happened. Simpson was handed a 2-year prison sentence, suspended for 2 years. He must also complete 150 hours of unpaid work within 12 months, and he must complete 6 rehabilitation activity requirement days. He was also banned from the road for 3 years, and he must pay costs of £150.
Next story, it's all change on the buses. Oxfordshire Bus Group, which runs Oxford Bus Company, has been renamed to reflect its network expansion. Now operating as Go Thames Valley, the transport group said the new identity better represented its expanding network spanning Oxfordshire, Buckinghamshire, Berkshire, Gloucestershire, the Cotswolds and beyond. The group includes Oxford Bus Company, Thames Travel, Carousel Buses, Pullums, Pierce's Coaches and City Sightseeing Oxford, and is owned by the Go Ahead Group. Luke Marion, Managing Director of Go Thames Valley, said, the new name for our group of companies better reflects who we are as a business, our market position, and where we are going. This will provide greater clarity and longevity for us as we continue to develop our network and adjust to local government reorganisation. The network now spans Oxfordshire, Buckinghamshire, Berkshire, Gloucestershire, the Cotswolds and beyond. The rebrand was timed with expected changes to local government structures, including the move to single-tier unitary councils and higher-level regional authorities. While the new umbrella brand has been introduced, each operating company will keep its name and continue to use its own website, email and social media channels. The Go Ahead Group acquired Pullum's in June 2023 and Pierce's in March 2025. Carousel Buses stepped in to replace a large number of services in July 2024 following the closure of Arriva's Buckinghamshire depots. Go Thames Valley now employs 1,300 people and operates a fleet of 540 vehicles, 132 of which are electric. Earlier this month, an investment of £1.5 million allowed Oxford Bus Company to put four new electric buses into service on routes across Oxfordshire. The investment included £446,000 of support from Oxfordshire County Council. The new buses bring the company's total electric fleet to 117 vehicles. These buses carry up to 45 passengers with 26 seats and dedicated space for wheelchairs and buggies. The environmentally friendly vehicles are also equipped with air conditioning powered by a zero emission heat pump.
And now it's time for the editor's piece. Back in the 1990s, I worked for Oxford University Press, and one of my colleagues was a woman called Sally Dexter. She was not, as I later learned, the well-known actor who appeared later on in Emmerdale, but she was the daughter of one of Britain's most celebrated crime writers, Colin Dexter, best known for creating the iconic detective Chief Inspector Morse. The Morse stories combine intricate mysteries, intellectual puzzles, and richly developed characters, earning their author an international reputation as a master of detective fiction. Through his writing, Dexter transformed the traditional detective novel and left a lasting legacy in both literature and, of course, in television. Norman Colin Dexter, to give him his full name, was born on the 29th of September 1930 in Stamford, Lincolnshire. He attended Stamford School before studying classics at Christ College, Cambridge. His passion for classical literature, history and language would later become defining features of his novels. After graduating, Dexter worked as a teacher of classics in Leicester before moving to Oxford in the 1960s. Increasingly deaf, he became an administrator and later assistant secretary at the University of Oxford Delegacy of Local Examinations. His writing career began almost by accident. During a family holiday in Wales in the early 1970s, poor weather confined him indoors, and he decided, as you do, to write a detective story. The result was Last Bus to Woodstock, published in 1975, which was the first novel featuring Chief Inspector Morse. The book won instant critical acclaim and introduced readers to a detective unlike any other. Morse was brilliant, but flawed, with a love of classical music, literature, crossword puzzles, real ale, and of course Jaguar cars. His complex personality and sharp intellect made him one of the most memorable detectives in modern fiction. Over the next two decades, Dexter wrote 13 Morse novels, including The Silent World of Nicholas Quinn, The Dead of Jericho, The Wench is Dead, and The Remorseful Day. His plots were known for their clever twists, fair play clues and literary references, challenging readers to solve the mysteries alongside Morse. Oxford itself became an important character in the series, with its colleges, libraries and historic streets providing atmospheric backdrop. The popularity of the books led to the television adaptation Inspector Morse, starring John Thor as Morse and Kevin Whatley as Sergeant Lewis, and, of course, a 1960 Mark II Jaguar. The series became one of Britain's most successful detective dramas and introduced Dekker's work to millions of viewers around the world because the series was sold internationally. Dexter frequently made cameo appearances in episodes, delighting fans. Okay. Dexter is also partially sighted, or was partially sighted, suffering from macular degeneration, and helped to raise hundreds of thousands of pounds for the My Vision charity in Oxfordshire to open their £500,000 resource centre in 2012. Throughout his career, Dexter received numerous honours for his contribution to crime fiction. He was awarded the Crime Writers Association Gold Dagger twice and received the Cartier Diamond Dagger for lifetime achievement. In 2000, he was appointed an OBE for services to literature. He died on the 21st of March 2017 at the grand old age of 86, leaving two children, Jeremy and her sister Sally, of course. His novels remain classics of detective fiction. They're admired for their intelligence, wit, and memorable characters. Chief Inspector Morse continues to captivate readers and viewers alike, securing his place among the greatest crime writers of the 20th century. Now, it's time for part two, and as usual, we begin with notices of local deaths. Oh. Sorry, we'll have to stop again. There's somebody outside. And now it's time for one of our regular reflections. And this evening we're delighted to welcome Richard Bowler, who's a preacher at the local Methodist church.
Thank you. Good evening. Today has been another warm, or maybe for some, even a hot day, with the temperature reaching 27 degrees earlier today. It's not cooled much yet either, actually. This has certainly been a hot, dry summer, and widespread significant rain last fell across much of the UK in mid-June of this year, with most of England recording under 10 millimetres of cumulative precipitation since June the 15th. Though isolated, light local showers have occurred sporadically. It does seem amazing how we can get used to some temperatures quite quickly. A few weeks ago, we were having extreme temperatures for several days running of in the mid-30 degrees. With the temperatures now dropping to 25 to 27 degrees, it seems quite cool, doesn't it? And it's almost quite normal and bearable even. I seem to remember years ago when if we had those temperatures in the summer, we would think, this is great, 27 degrees, oh, that's a lovely temperature. But now we're having the mid-30s and it's getting too hot. How happily, though, we accept the standard, the normal temperatures now. We've had several periods of heat wave this year, and it made me wonder what defines a heat wave in the UK. A UK heat wave threshold is met when a location records a period of at least three consecutive days with daily maximum temperatures meeting or exceeding the heat wave temperature threshold. The threshold varies around the country. In some parts of the country, where the normal average high temperature may be 25, anything over that triggers a heat wave. I'm sure the majority of us can remember the heat wave of 1976. I was just 11 that year and finishing at primary school. And to me at the time, I think it was wonderful. Long, hot summer days off, away from school, plenty of ice creams and paddling pools to go into. I don't think I really appreciated what it had effect on everybody else. And it finally came to an end when, guess what? The government appointed a minister for drought and the rains came. This week has been the first week of the school holidays, and I'm sure that many parents and guardians are happy that the weather this year hasn't done what it often seems to do. As soon as the schools stop, the weather breaks and we have days of rain. But how we do need that rain now today. If only it could rain during the night, when most of us are asleep, that would be perfect. But I guess we do ask for a lot, really, don't we? And we are British, and we do like to moan about the weather, don't we? Whether it's hot or cold, wet or dry. But thankfully, the holiday season is here. A time for families and friends to meet together, to relax, to get away from some of the stresses of life and work and school, to possibly visit places, maybe get to the seaside and even paddle in the sea. We think of all those people still working in the heat and those having to deal with the consequences, including forest fires and farmers' fields similarly burning. As some of you may remember on previous reflections I've done, I've mentioned that I have an allotment growing various different vegetables and salad ingredients. This year has been a tough one, with some seeds not germinating and those that do needing a lot of extra care, particularly a lot of watering, which thankfully we have water tanks nearby, so we won't be affected by the hosepipe ban that came into force today in this area. It was amazing as I walked around last night to see how many cars were being cleaned before the hosepipe ban came in place. Seeing my own allotment and the farmers' fields around me reminded me of the parable of the sower. When the sower sowed the seeds into the ground, and they landed in four different types of soil, which react in four different ways. Looking at how good and reactive each soil may be. It's like each of us hearing the message, but responding to it differently. I pray that we may all be like the soil that is receptive to the message, and with feeding and nurturing, like we add fertilizer and soil to the soil and water it, we may truly grow like that seed, like the sunflower that comes from a very small seed and slowly grows and grows bigger and bigger, shining out ahead of us all and sharing the love of God. So I pray that we thank you, Lord, for all your gifts, and especially for the seed of your word planted in our hearts. May we take your message of love and use it to bear good fruit in our lives, serving others for your name's sake. Amen.
Thank you, Richard, for those, if I may say so, warm words. And now it's time for part two, and as usual, we begin with notices of local deaths, of which three were reported in the Witney Gazette this week. On the 23rd of June, age 67, Andrew Frank William Pledge. On the 27th of June, aged 81, Susan Lorraine Carter. And with no date given, William Bill Williamson, aged 98. Our condolences to all their friends and families from all of us here at WTN. And now moving on to the quiz. And here are the answers to last week's quiz. Jolly good luck to all our readers in answering these. Number one, the film Anne of a Thousand Days portrayed which queen?
Anne Boleyn.
Yep, Anne Boleyn. That's all she made, 1,000 days. Number two, born William Henry Pratt, who was the first actor to play Frankenstein's creation?
Boris Karloff.
Well done, Boris Karloff. Evidence of misspent youth there, watching too much TV. Number three, in which limb are the soleus muscles?
Leg.
Yep, it's in the leg.
50-50 guess.
And number four, how many times was Queen Elizabeth I married?
She wasn't.
No, indeed, she was the Virgin Queen, so she was never married. And finally, which singer was nicknamed the Queen of Soul? It was Aretha Franklin, yep. And now for this week's quiz, which is all about Oxfordshire. So a chance for you to test your local knowledge. Which Oxfordshire town is generally regarded as being the gateway to the Cotswolds? Number two, which of the following is not an Oxfordshire river? Evenlode, Cherwell, Glyme, Nene. Number three, Bampton is the claimed home of which traditional entertainment? Number four, which Oxford pub was the meeting place of the authors J.R.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis? And finally, which of the following counties does not share a border with Oxfordshire? And there's a choice of four: Gloucestershire, Hampshire, Warwickshire, and Berkshire. And now we go back to our news. And we're going to start off with an article about a proposed speed limit. And that's over to Jill.
Council proposes more road speed limit changes. Oxfordshire County Council is consulting on potential speed limit changes. The council is in discussions with local town and parish councils, including those in Witney, Ducklington and Kerbridge, about proposed changes. For the A40, the suggested changes include implementing a 50 miles per hour limit from Shaws Green to Ensham Park and Ride, a 40 miles per hour limit between Astle Junction and Burford, and a 50 miles per hour limit between Burford and Gloucestershire. The A415 could see a 50 miles per hour limit from Ducklington Roundabout to Cokethorpe, and a 40 miles per hour limit between Cokethorpe and Stanlake. For the A4095, a combination of 40 mile per hour limit and 50 mile per hour limit are proposed between Witney, Kerbridge and Bampton. A road within Westall near Burford has opened for consultation with Oxfordshire County Council, asking people to share their opinions on moving the road from a 30 miles per hour to a 20 miles per hour. In June, Oxfordshire County Council confirmed that speed limits on around 60 A and B roads could be reduced over the next year following a county-wide review, the first major reassessment of rural limits in about 15 years. The review follows decisions to cut limits from 60 miles per hour to 20 miles per hour on four roads near Witney after sharp traffic growth and concerns about injury or death, and has already produced some reductions from the national speed limit to 50 miles per hour or 40 miles per hour on certain sections.
And the next story is called Mock Mayor Dunked in Bonkers Tradition, and it has a bonkers picture to go with it, which I'll describe to you at the end of the report. A mock mayor has been chosen in what has been described as a bonkers tradition. Old Woodstock's latest mock mayor was chosen in a ceremony that involved dunking the new representatives in a river. Dating back to the 18th century, the event originated as a playful jibe by Old Woodstock at its royally established neighbour of New Woodstock. It came about after a town hall was built in the latter, that's New Woodstock, with a mock mayor aimed at parodying the actual political mayor. Tim Nelson was elected this year, having previously tried to be elected several other times, and he held his mock court, as is tradition, before being dunked in the River Glyme. Karen Jones, who is part of the team which organises the event, said, "We're committed to our community event and raising money for local charities. We love our town and want everyone to feel welcome and included in such a wonderful celebration of our history. Yes, it might seem a bit bonkers, but it has stood the test of time for hundreds of years." And it certainly is bonkers. There's a picture of half a dozen or more local folks, some dressed in robes, some dressed in bowler hats, one in a tricorn hat, and one with a top hat. I think he's the mock mayor because he's got a chain round his neck with a medallion on it. There's also somebody holding what looks like, I'm sure it is, a replica rather than the original, of that gold toilet that was stolen from the palace a few years back.
And the next item is Air Ambulance Saves Lives with Blood Transfusions. Life-saving blood transfusions are being delivered to patients before they even reach hospital. Thames Valley Air Ambulance crews gave urgent transfusions to 76 seriously ill or injured patients, including four children, at the scene of emergencies during the past year. Patients were treated across the region, with 19 in Berkshire, 24 in Buckinghamshire, 24 in Oxfordshire, and 9 in surrounding areas. Adam Panter, Chief Operating Officer at Thames Valley Air Ambulance, said, "World Blood Donor Day is a good time for us to take stock and reflect on the difference blood products make when a life hangs in the balance. When someone is losing a lot of blood, for example, after a road traffic collision, they need a transfusion at the scene. But as a charity, none of this could happen without the support of our community. Every time we put the key in the ignition of our blood delivery van, or we power up our blood warming machine, it's people like you that make it possible. Thank you." One patient who benefited from this emergency care was Stephanie Thorpe, who received immediate transfusions after a head-on collision. A second Thames Valley Air Ambulance vehicle delivered additional blood to the scene, and she received 8 units in total. Stephanie said, "It's because of these people that I'm still here. My son still has a mum, my husband still has a wife. Thanks to Thames Valley Air Ambulance, I've been given the chance to grow old."
This story about helping young people into employment, which is what GWR, the railway company, are doing. Great Western Railway has been named one of the country's top 100 apprenticeship employers. The train operator earned national recognition in the government's Top Apprenticeship Employers 2026 rankings, which celebrate organisations delivering outstanding apprenticeship programmes. Ashley Bray, Human Resources Director at GWR, said, "It's another achievement we can be immensely proud of. To be recognised alongside some of the country's leading employers reflects the dedication of our teams, and most importantly, the talent and commitment of our apprentices. Combined with becoming the first train operator to achieve platinum accreditation for our apprenticeship programme, this recognition reinforces our commitment to creating real opportunities for diverse young people from our local communities to build rewarding careers in the railway." The company's apprenticeship journey began in 2011 with just 15 apprentices. Since then, it has expanded to offer more than 17 programmes and now supports more than 300 apprentices in a variety of roles across its network. GWR Learning and Development Manager Andrew Perry said, "We've been on an incredible journey since launching our first apprenticeship programme in 2011 with just 15 apprentices. To be recognised as one of the country's top 100 apprenticeship employers is fantastic recognition of everyone's hard work and the positive experience our apprentices have throughout their journey with us. One standout example is Sophie Carter, a 22-year-old customer services apprentice from Plymouth. Ms. Carter went on to a driver-manager apprenticeship, where she led a project run a train crewed entirely by current and former apprentices during the National Apprenticeship Week. The initiative was praised by Secretary of State for Transport Heidi Alexander MP. Ms. Carter said, "I've been given opportunities I never imagined, from developing new skills and gaining qualifications to leading projects that have made a real difference."
Pub named finalist in UK Industry Awards. A Cotswold pub has been named as a finalist in a UK Industry Awards and is set to defend its title, having won the accolade at last year's ceremony. The Bull at Cholbury, near Chipping Norton, is an award-winning 16th century public house, which has been a cornerstone of the village for centuries. No stranger to awards for its high-end bed and board, the cosy inn already features in the Michelin Guide and on the Estrella Damm Top 50 Gastropubs list. It's now been shortlisted as a finalist for the Great British Pub Awards 2026, going up against five others in the category of Best Pub for Food.
My headline is Cricket Club Receives £4,000 Boost. Chipping Norton and District Cricket Club has been awarded a £4,000 donation from Carla Holmes to help support the team expansion plans. The club wants to expand its facilities to cater for the women's and girls' teams, as well as walking cricket for senior players. This would include, or the money would fund, building new showers and toilets. The club has been fundraising to meet its £25,000 target for the work, and the £4,000 donation from Carla will go towards that total. Martin Elliott, treasurer of the club, said, "We are extremely grateful and thankful to Carla Holmes for their generous donation to our club. We had an ambitious target to reach, and their support helps. It will make it all possible."
The next item is Wilderness Festival set to be a classic. Preparations are well underway for the most fabulous festival of the summer, Wilderness, taking place among the rolling acres, parkland, woods and lakes of Cornbury Park near Cholbury. The festival is a gem and attracts a creative, glamorous crowd who embrace the event's eccentricity and shimmering style. Dressing up is encouraged and the results are never short of impressive. Always a highlight of the summer, this year's, which takes place from July the 30th to August the 2nd, is set to be a classic. Musical highlights include Scissor Sisters, Carl Cox, The Last Dinner Party, and a show curated by Annie Lennox. Also up are Soul Wax, Baxter Dury, Saint Etienne, Good Neighbours, the Hot Eight Brass Band, Groove Armada, Nick Fanciulli, Eats Everything, Olivia F., Leo and Bushwhacker, and more.
It was a different kind of festival last weekend, full of old relics. Whitney was letting off steam in a big way last weekend. The West Oxfordshire Steam and Vintage Show was held at Shaw's Green on Saturday and Sunday. It was a jam-packed weekend of steam engines, vintage vehicles, demonstrations and countryside fun, with one visitor calling it cracking. Crowds enjoying the sunshine saw working traction engines in action and could get up close to classic cars, vintage tractors and motorbikes from all eras. The showground was also home to fairground rides and entertaining arena displays, as well as trade stands and food stalls with plenty for all ages to enjoy. "Our mission," said a spokesman, "is to keep Britain's steam and vintage heritage alive, and that's exactly what the West Oxfordshire Steam and Vintage Show does best."
And now it's time for our notice board. And there are quite a few musical events taking place in the week ahead. Unusually, we have no listeners' birthdays to announce this week, but we do have a new listener. So a very warm welcome to Mrs. Joan McFarlane of Whitney. Well, the Wilderness Festival is happening shortly, as Tina reported, but first and foremost, a rival to it and celebrating its 29th year, we have the Truck Festival, which will be taking place between Tuesday the 23rd and Monday the 27th of July. So it's already underway, or just about to be underway. It's an annual event held near Steventon, and it was once called the birthday party that got out of control. It's been dubbed the UK's most warped village fete, and it's a four-day celebration of the best of new and established artists. Thames Travel will be providing a shuttle service to and from the festival and Didcot Parkway Railway Station. For more info and pricing, ticket pricing, please email info@truckfestival.com. Then on Saturday the 25th of July, from 7:30 to 9:30 at St Mary's Church in North Aston, we have the Moonrakers four-piece folk band, who'll play a concert of inventive arrangements of traditional British songs and tunes alongside powerful original compositions. Tickets are £15 on the door, or in advance, simply dial 07913 487 558. On the same day, but earlier in the day, from 12 until onwards, not exactly a musical event, although there will be live music there, at St Michael's Church in Stanton Harcourt, we have the Stanton Harcourt Beer Festival. So a day of great brews, food, music, and lots of fun. General entry to the festival is absolutely free, but the beer isn't. And then on the 23rd of July, on Saturday, 10 o'clock in the morning in Woodstock, if you know of or are a veteran of the armed forces, the Veterans Coffee Morning will be held at the Soldiers of Oxfordshire Museum with free entry for all veterans with complimentary tea, coffee and biscuits, and model making provided by Models for Heroes. On August the 9th, advance notice here, at the Holywell Music Room, Oxford, it's the fourth concert of his 38th annual summer piano series by acclaimed pianist Jack Gibbons, who's joined by the award-winning pianist Sarah Beth Briggs for an evening of beloved piano duets from Schubert to Gershwin. Call the box office for tickets, and I understand they're selling fast. That's 01865 305 305. Finally, here in the notices section, believe it or not, a reminder to test your electric blanket. I know electric blankets are probably the very last thing on your mind right now, but it's better to be prepared. The two dates for our area are the 24th of September at Willow Gardens, Chipping Norton, and the 8th of October at the Council Offices, Wood Green, Whitney. To book an appointment, call 01865 519 800 or book online at service.oxfordshire.gov.uk/blanket testing, all one word. Now, our listener representative, Anne Martin, is unfortunately unable to continue in this role. And so we're looking for a replacement listener representative for the Whitney Talking News Committee. If this is something you'd like to do, or you would like to know more about it and what it entails, it's not particularly burdensome, please place a slip of paper in your pouch and we'll call you. It's a very valuable contribution to our service and helps shape the service that we provide to you. Well, that's all for this rather warm week. If you're not listening online and have a USB memory stick, please remove the stick from the playback unit and close the metal shield. Remember to reverse the plastic address label on the yellow or blue pouch before posting the stick back to us. Any postbox will do. If you wish to get in touch, just leave a slip of paper in your pouch and we'll ring you. As well as listening to the USB stick some of you receive from us each week, there are lots of other ways for you to listen to all our editions, including the magazines. Whitney Talking News is available completely for free online via our website, wtn.org.uk. And please remember to pass on the details to anyone who might like to listen to your weekly local news programme. And keep listening at the very end of our programme for an infosound item which gives some highlights of this week's best radio listening and audio described TV. Finally, big thanks to our readers tonight, Jill Breakspear, Tina Ewens, Alan Ravel and Mick Walsh. Thanks also to our great support team, to Peter Brading, who's been recording this session on our venerable computer, and to Jan Butler and Valerie Palmer, who have been checking all the pouches and memory sticks you have returned and keeping all our admin records in good order. And finally, thanks also to Richard Bowler for his reflection this week. Before we all go home, The very last task of tonight will fall to Alan and Nick, who will be copying the USB sticks and packing them in their little wallets, ready to send out to you all. Now, as you'll undoubtedly remember, we end every episode with a joke. So here's this week's. Why on earth do elephants hate penguins? It's because they just can't get the wrappers off. So after that, I'm sure everyone would like to say goodbye. So until our next edition,
goodbye. Goodbye.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
Here are the radio listings for the 7 days beginning Saturday the 25th of July, compiled by Wendy and read by Gilly. Starting with Saturday the 25th of July, and a reminder that the BBC proms are in full swing and can be heard on Radio 3 at various times each day. On Saturday, there are proms at 2 p.m, 4 p.m. and 7:30 p.m. They continue throughout the week, mostly at 7 p.m. There's a celebration of a comedy classic paying tribute to Some Mothers Do Have 'Em on Radio 4 Extra at 3 p.m. and 9 p.m. A collection of 5 Victorian love stories by authors including Oscar Wilde is on Radio 4 Extra at 7:30 a.m, 12:30 p.m. and 6:30 p.m. Then, from Archive on 4, comes The People's Pool, exploring the story of the Govanhill Baths in Glasgow on Radio 4 at 8 p.m. Moving on to Sunday the 26th of July. The castaway in Desert Island Discs is legendary cinematographer Sir Roger Deakins. It's on Radio 4 at 10 a.m. While Desert Island Discs Revisited features the Olympic rower Catherine Granger on Radio 4 Extra at 6 a.m, 11 a.m. and 5 p.m. A new 17-part series of the nationwide general knowledge quiz Brain of Britain starts today on Radio 4 at 4:30 p.m. News from Nowhere is an adaptation of the 1890 novel by William Morris, his utopian vision of a future England which has left industrialisation behind. Radio 4 Extra at 6:30 p.m. In Unreliable Narrator, a violent assault during his teenage years erased nearly all of Stephen McCall's memories. Charting his journey back to hope and happiness, he reveals how he has had to piece together the story of his life on Radio 4 at 7:15 p.m. And from our own correspondent is on Radio 4 at 9:30 p.m. Turning now to those programmes which are broadcast at the same time every day from Monday to Friday. In The Time of My Life, we meet retired professionals spending their senior years in care homes that cater for specific trades on Radio 4 Extra at 9:30 a.m. every day this week. There are stories featuring the gentleman thief Raffles on Radio 4 Extra at 6 a.m, 11 a.m. and 5 p.m. Monday to Friday. The book of the week is Confessions of a Performative Male, in which the author, Darren McGarvey, asks probing questions about masculinity. on Radio 4 at 11:45 a.m. each day this week. Small Island is a dramatisation in 15 parts of Andrea Levy's 2004 novel exploring empire, prejudice, war and love in Jamaica, England, America and India. It's on Radio 4 Extra every day this week and beyond at 8:45 a.m, 1:45 p.m. and 7:45 p.m. Patricia Hodge reads an adaptation of E. Nesbitt's fantasy novel The Phoenix and the Carpet on Radio 4 Extra at 3:45 p.m. and 9:45 p.m. Monday to Friday. The composer of the week is London-born composer Alice Mary Smith, 1839 to 1884, on Radio 3 at 4 p.m. every day this week. The book at bedtime, Wild Dark Shore, continues on Radio 4 at 10:45 p.m. Monday to Friday. Now, some individual programmes to listen to through the week, starting with Monday the 27th of July. How Did We Get Here? No World Order starts a new series exploring the background to current conflicts on Radio 4 at 9:30 a.m. The conversation brings us a discussion on the different strengths of men and women on BBC World Service at 1:30 p.m. Gertrude Stein and the Liberation Fruitcake, described as a kitchen monologue by Patricia Hanna. Sounds intriguing. It's on Radio 4 Extra at 3 p.m. and 9 p.m. For fans of the panel show, there's an episode of The Kitchen Cabinet on Radio 4 at 4:30 p.m. While Just a Minute, hosted by Sue Perkins, continues on Radio 4 at 6:30 p.m. Some suggestions for Tuesday the 28th of July. In Invisible Hands, The American Century, David Dimbleby charts how in the middle of the 20th century, America became a superpower and began to shape the world around it. This new six-part series begins on Radio 4 at 9 a.m. and is repeated tomorrow at 9 p.m. In A Fork in the Road, BBC correspondent Gary O'Donoghue reports on a sheep farm situated in the middle of the M62 on Radio 4 Extra at 10:30 a.m. and 4:30 p.m. Lucy Worsley's latest series, Lady on Trial, today brings us the story of protester Connie Bolam, who during the Second World War became the first woman to be sent to prison as a conscientious objector. It's on Radio 4 at 3 p.m. Jamaica, Shaken, Not Broken, explores the impact of last October's Hurricane Melissa, which devastated many of Jamaica's 1,600 places of worship, and follows the efforts of volunteers to salvage their sacred spaces. It's on Radio 4 at 3:30 p.m. In Touch brings us news, views and information for people who are blind or partially sighted, presented as usual by Peter White, on Radio 4 at 8:40 p.m. Moving on to Wednesday the 29th of July, The Missing Hancocks brings us another recreation of a lost classic on Radio 4 Extra at 7:30 a.m, 12:30 p.m. and 6:30 p.m. In the series United Kingdoms from 2021, writers reflect life across the UK. Today's programme explores the idea of shelter on Radio 4 at 2:15 p.m. Choral Evensong comes from Gloucester Cathedral during the Three Choirs Festival on Radio 3 at 3 p.m. In Map of the Moon, Siddharth Khajuria examines how people perceive the moon, Starting with some of the earliest lunar maps, he works with moonlight to illuminate thornier questions about our own behaviour on Earth on Radio 4 at 3:30 p.m. To round off the evening, actor and folk music fan Michael Sheen sits in for Mark Radcliffe on The Folk Show on Radio 2 at 9 p.m. Moving on to Thursday the 30th of July, Natalie Haynes stands up for the classics, begins a new seven-part series with Alexandria, the Science, revealing the creativity and breadth of the scientific inventions made in that ancient city, on Radio 4 at 9 a.m. In Art That Conquered the World, James Fox examines Vermeer's Girl with a Pearl Earring, asking why it has become so dominant while other masterpieces by the Dutch artist are now less well known. Radio 4 at 9:30 a.m. In a programme from 2002, in the series Great Lives, the subject is jazz giant Louis Armstrong, on Radio 4 Extra at 10 a.m. and 4 p.m. Year Tides, Lunusa, is a drama infusing storytelling and song, and inspired by the myths and rituals surrounding this pagan harvest festival, on Radio 4 at 2:15 p.m. In This Natural Life, this week, nature writer Patrick Barkham takes Martha Kearney on a butterfly-spotting trip in Foxley Wood, Norfolk's largest ancient woodland, on Radio 4 at 3 p.m. BBC Inside Science is on Radio 4 at 4:30 p.m. And James Marriott and a guest share their thoughts on a topical issue in Radical, on Radio 4 at 11 p.m. And finally, to Friday the 31st of July, the series Soul Music this week looks at Louis Armstrong's What a Wonderful World, on Radio 4 Extra at 10 a.m. Classical Live brings us some highlights from this week's proms, last month's Alborough Festival and more, on Radio 3 at 1 p.m. Living on the Edge today meets the warden at the Bird Observatory on Spurn Point in the East Riding of Yorkshire, on Radio 4 at 2:45 p.m. Gardener's Question Time answers listeners' questions, on Radio 4 at 3 p.m. Enjoy your listening week.
Hello, this is Demi welcoming you to your Audio Describe TV programmes for the week starting Saturday the 25th and ending Friday the 31st of July. And thanks to Christine, who has written this week. So, starting with Saturday, film buffs have a great Saturday in store with movie choices throughout the afternoon and evening, but the day starts with the usual Channel 4 American Sitcom Fest from 6 a.m. through to 12:35. The first of the film choices is at 7 a.m. on ITV, Sean Connery as Bond in Diamonds Are Forever. Then at 12, Prue Leith welcomes Alison Hammond to her Cotswold kitchen on ITV, while BBC Two has The Great British Sewing Bee. The classic 1940s romantic drama Casablanca is on BBC Two at 2:50 p.m. Comedy with Night at the Museum on BBC One at 3:50, and fantasy adventure Nanny McPhee at 4:05 p.m. Into the evening, and Jamie Cullum is the guest star in episode 2 of The Piano on Channel 4 at 6:30. ITV has A Deal or No Deal celebrity special at 7, and BBC Two continues Chris Packham's story of evolution at 7:30. Your evening film options are motor racing drama Gran Turismo at 9, mystery thriller The Infernal Machine at 11:40, both on Channel 4, and over on BBC One, the epic Gladiator at 10:20. But if that's not for you, there's BBC One's Casualty at 9:10pm and the start of a new series on ITV, The Staircase, a US true crime about a woman found dead after reportedly falling down a flight of stairs, but the police soon focus their attention on her husband. You have two episodes from 9:15pm. Now on to Sunday. The American comedy sitcoms run from 5:55am to 10am on Channel 4, while over on BBC One, you can travel the North Wales Pilgrim's Way in Pilgrimage at 10:30am and visit Long Marston in Warwickshire for Bargain Hunt at 12:15. Fern Britton's Inside the Vets is at 11:30am, Tom Kerridge Cooks Italy at 12:30, Love Your Garden is at 1pm and Deal or No Deal Celebrity Special at 2:10pm, all on ITV, while over on BBC One there is an appeal on behalf of Tourette's Action in Lifeline at 1:55, followed by The Mating Game at 2:05. You have two afternoon film options: fantasy comedy Doolittle at 3:05 on BBC One and Roger Moore as James Bond in Live and Let Die at 3:10 on ITV. Alternatively, you might enjoy Our Farm Next Door at 3:55pm, followed by Britain's Favourite Railways at 5, both on Channel 4. Or Homes Under the Hammer at 4:35 and Celebrity Escape to the Country at 6, both on BBC One. A new documentary, Force of Nature, examines how life on Earth is impacted by the sun. The series starts on ITV at 7pm. At 9, acclaimed jazz artist Hiromi is the star guest on Channel 4's The Piano. It's the penultimate episode of ITV's The Dark, and a new series starts on BBC One, The Rapture, a psychological thriller based on the best-selling novel by Liz Jensen. There are four films to conclude your evening choices: The Forgiven at 10 on Channel 4, Taxi Driver also at 10, and The Elephant Man at 11:50, both on BBC Two, and I Am Legend on 10:30, BBC One. While ITV examines the 2006 plot by terrorists to smuggle liquid explosives onto transatlantic airliners in Terror in the Skies at 10:20. Now, for the programmes which are on at the same time, same channel, each weekday. In the mornings, Channel 4 has episodes of Everybody Loves Raymond from 7:45am and Frasier from 9:10am, while over on BBC One there is Animal Park at 9:30am. In the afternoons, Channel 4 gives you Find It, Fix It, Flog It at 12:10, Narrow Escapes at 4, Chateau DIY at 5, and American Pickers at 6, while on BBC Two you can join the Hairy Bikers Bakecation at 2:45, and Earth from Space at 4:15. With BBC One following The Travelling Auctioneers at 4:30. Then it's the regular soap slots, EastEnders, 7:30 on BBC One every weeknight except Friday, Emmerdale at 8 o'clock, Coronation Street at 8:30 on ITV. Now for Monday. BBC One's Homes Under the Hammer is at 11:15am and ITV's Dickinson's Real Deal is at 2. Then it's Into the Evening with Just One Thing at 6:30 on BBC Two, which examines how borrowing a pet could reduce your blood pressure. Fletcher's Family Farm continues on BBC Two at 7:30, and the series Dover 24/7, Britain's busiest port, on Channel 4 at 8. At 9, you have four continuing series to choose from. BBC One's The Rapture, BBC Two's Evolution, Channel 4's 24 Hours in A&E, and the final episode of ITV's The Dark. Mortimer and Whitehouse visit the Lake District in Gone Fishing on BBC Two at 10, and there are more Secret Lives of Gypsy Wives on Channel 4 also at 10. Actor Toby Jones explores his family history in Who Do You Think You Are? At 10:40 on BBC One, and the case of American influencer Alexis Sharkey is examined in Murder Gone Viral at 10:45 on ITV. You've two evening film choices, Hope and Glory on BBC Two at 11:05, and the Alan Bennett classic, The Lady in the Van, on BBC One at 11:40, while ITV continues its Love and Death series at 11:40. On to Tuesday now, you can visit the Carmarthen Antiques and Flea Market in Wales for BBC One's Bargain Hunt at 12:15pm. Then your evening choices start with BBC Two's Just One Thing at 6:30pm, with Zoe Ball prescribing 10 minutes of sunshine a day for a man with a history of heart attacks. Still on BBC Two, you have Rick Stein's Food Stories at 7, with Rick discovering the history behind the Yorkshire pudding, followed by Amazing Hotels at 8, this episode taking you to the Six Senses Hotel in Ibiza. Also at 8, there's The Great British Sewing Bee on BBC One, and the start of a new series on Channel 4, Hotel Chocolat Unwrapped, which takes you behind the scenes at one of Britain's biggest independent chocolate brands. Two new series start at 9 on BBC Two, The Vampire Lestat, Interview with the Vampire, which is based on the novels by Anne Rice, and on ITV, Cold Case Forensics, The Death of God's Banker, a documentary exploring the casebook of forensic scientist Dr. Angela Gallup. Also at 9, on BBC One, the series Murder 24/7 continues, and on Channel 4, it's The Undeclared War, followed by Gogglebox at 10 and First Dates at 11:05. You also have a film choice, action comedy Bad Boys at 10:45 on ITV. Next, your programmes for Wednesday. Terrace Properties in Yorkshire, Cheshire and the Midlands feature in Homes Under the Hammer at 11:15am on BBC One. Then your evening choices start at 6:30 with BBC Two's Just One Thing. Roman Kemp discovers how a nightly hot bath could aid sleep and reduce the risk of heart disease. At 8 o'clock you can choose between BBC One's The Repair Shop, BBC Two's Saving Lives at Sea, or the start of a new series on Channel 4, Extraordinary Extensions, which follows British homeowners as they embark on ambitious home extension projects. Lucy Worsley investigates the gunpowder plot on BBC Two at 9, while Murder 24/7 continues on BBC One and The Undeclared War on Channel 4. At 10, you've 24 Hours in A&E on Channel 4 and Inside Number 9 on BBC Two, followed by Uncanny at 11. You also have an evening film choice, Roger Moore as Bond in Live and Let Die at 10:45 on ITV. And so to Thursday. Can dark chocolate lower the risk of diabetes and boost our brains? Find out in Just One Thing at 6:30 on BBC Two, which is followed by Escape to the Country at 7 and Digging for Britain at 8. Over on ITV, Tom Kerridge cooks Italy at 7:30, and at 8 o'clock you have Fake or Fortune on BBC One, which features a landscape believed to be by French artist André de Rain, which, if authenticated, could be worth hundreds of thousands of pounds. Also at 8, Renovation Rescue returns to Channel 4, with the team coming to the aid of families who have had bad experiences with builders, followed by Murder Case, the digital detectives at 9, and all three episodes of Don't Date Brandon from 10 into the early hours, a true crime documentary about two women's experiences with the same man. Meanwhile, on BBC One, Dame Harriet Walter uncovers her mother's secret role in Allied intelligence during the Second World War in Who Do You Think You Are? The chase around the world continues on ITV, and it's the second episode of The Devil in the Family, The Fall of Ruby Frank, on BBC Two, all at 9 o'clock. Your evening choices conclude with two episodes of Murder 24/7 from 10:40 p.m. And finally, Friday. In the afternoon, you have The Hairdresser Mysteries at 2 o'clock on BBC One and Hippos, Africa's River Giants at 4:15 on BBC Two. Clive Meary learns about the life-enhancing benefits of press-ups in BBC Two's Just One Thing at 6:30. And Durham's Easington Colliery Band prepares for a concert to mark the 75th anniversary of one of the region's worst pit disasters in Our Lives at 7:30, followed by the Granite Harbour series at 8, both on BBC One. Also at 8, it's Surgery Secrets of the Super Rich on Channel 4, and at 9, you've Bergerac on BBC Two and two episodes of The Twisted Tale of Amanda Knox on ITV. The comedy series Anne Droid continues at 9:30, the final two episodes of Austin from 10:40, and the Oscar-winning drama Scent of a Woman at 11:35, all on BBC One. And chef Michael Rue hosts a masterclass for Inside the Langham, Britain's first grand hotel, at 11:55 on ITV. Well, that's it for this week. We hope you find plenty of programmes to enjoy, and we look forward to updating you again next week. Bye for now.
DNF Soundings.